Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 49, section 4, which is old single column, page 564. All right. Remember, we were working through those previous two sections last time, a pair, where they're dealing with the most immediate physical environmental issues that life has to be attuned to. When the life carriers design, you know, the life that they're going to implant on a world. So we worked our way through all of the those seven different variations in kind of the sort of the standard mode of variation, and with that exceptional case, you know, they devoted a whole section to above the non-breathers. In section 3, just, you know, remember what I mentioned, that tiny little kind of placeholder comment that they made, the item number 7 in section 2, right at the end of section 2 there, the unnamed types. And I mentioned that as we went forward a little ways, we would get into some of the physical variations that they were referring to there, so you'll see that as we go forward here. But more immediately, rather than more and more about the physical issues, they want to bring in the issues that are more immediately relevant to the intellectual and spiritual nature of the mortals on worlds. You see this first section we're going to do here, section 4. You know, when you speak of will creatures, you are talking about, you know, very directly that influence upon a mindal self that we call personality, and its attributes like free will, the exercise of free will upon the nature of that mindal self, you know, its eventual mastery because of that free will ability to take a hold of that mindal self and produce a cosmic character in that mindal self. So we're still, you know, it's not like they can get into any sort of immediate physics of mind energy or spirit energy, because that's just, you know, beyond our understanding. You know, so it's still going to have a bit of a physical sort of quality to the discussion here, but keep in mind that that's the main thing that we're thinking about is the intellectual and spiritual nature, as opposed to just immediately the physical issues like gravity and temperature, like we saw last time. All right, so let's see what they've got here.
4, evolutionary will creatures. There are great differences between the mortals of the different worlds, even among those belonging to the same intellectual and physical types. But all mortals of will dignity are erect animals, bipeds.
Okay, so just that one little tidbit they want us just put up front. And we touched upon that. That question kind of came up last time. And you're saying, well, wait a minute. We were reading about those evolutionary issues where sometimes you were having the first primitive humans where you still had air navigators or marine dwellers. You know, what do they mean that all mortals of will dignity are erect animals, bipeds? Remember what we said. Even if there is a brief little period early on, everyone is eventually becoming relatively material son and daughter like. Now, material sons and daughters are, you know, the archetype erect animal biped. They are that form of creature in the local universe, downstepped all the way as far as you can without actually going animal, literally animal, but downstepped until that will creature is seated upon an animal foundation. And, I mean, Material Son and Daughter didn't evolve up from animals like we did. But what they represent is the eventually of that material evolution up to the erect animal biped. Right? They're just, you know, all of that evolution is eventuated into their creation by the Creator Son, just, you know, right from the beginning. Whereas you know, on an evolutionary world, that eventuation that's bottled up in their beginning is all spread out over time, starting with single-celled plants and finally getting to single-celled animals and finally getting to will creatures. Right, through a long, often circuitous process. Okay, but so just remember again, it's not so much, you know, think about, why would it be that with all the complexity of evolution, it would always end up as these erect animal bipeds? It's because it isn't really coming from the bottom up. It might appear that way, you know, but what it really is a downstepping expression. Just in the same way that it appears that the absonite is subsequent to the finite. But really, you start with the absolute, you downstep it to the absonite, and then you downstep it to the finite. That's really how reality comes into existence. And so, you know, it's just a very distinct reminder that how biased and limited our perspective is right now. It may appear, you know, that time is this absolute backdrop, but it's not. Time is not a reality. Time is an appearance. Time is an appearance of your perception, you know, your relationship to this much downstepped absolute fact. That when you downstep the absolute through the absonite down into the finite, and there's creatures down in the finite, it appears to those creatures that they're the beginning and they're moving towards some remote ending. But really, you know, it's the other way around. They're the culmination. And you see shades of that just in the way a Creator Son does his bestowals, right? He doesn't do his bestowals when he's bestowing himself in a creature, you know, of our likeness. He doesn't start with the material babe, you know, and then do constellation level and then do super universe level. He does them in the other way around. He does the last, you know, from what appears to be the last first. Right. So, you know, just those little things that, even though that's kind of mind-boggling, to try to just let go of so much tension about, you know, that temporal appearance to things. Let yourself begin to exist in a more eternalized space where you aren't, you know, in a very disjoint, finite, hoping that someday there'll be a relationship to the absolute, right? You know, in your disjointed state. The absolute is where you began. And it'll appear that that's where you end, right? But it's really where you began. And you're not removed from the absolute. The absolute is your foundation, You're built upon it. If you can allow yourself to flip things around a little bit like that, you will find a greater stability in your life. Right? It won't seem so quicksand-like, this life that you're leading. When you recognize that the truth is, it all is sitting on the motionless isle, the antithesis of quicksand. Right? That's why Jesus had peace that passes all understanding, because he lived the truth that you aren't hoping that one day, hope against hope, that you'll get to the aisle. You started on the aisle. Maybe not experientially, but existentially you did. Existentially you started on the aisle. So you never have to worry about being able to find your way there again, right? It's built into you. Right. Okay, so the only reason I let myself go off on that tangent a bit is, you know, there in the title it says evolutionary will creatures, right? And you've got a juxtaposition there. You've got that appearance of evolution, you know, that seems to be starting with nothing and hopefully magically it'll get to something someday. But it's combined with will, which is an existential fact. You know, and from a temporal perspective, it's a mystery of mysteries that existential influence from eternity could identify with this lowly, seemingly Swiss cheese fact in time. Right? But see, when you see it in truth, it's really not a mystery at all, right? Because you aren't somehow magically reaching up to the existential. You actually began in the existential, just not experientially. Right? It's that personality can identify with you because deep down underneath all of that you can experience, you're already there where it's coming from. Right? Right? That influence from eternity isn't just a personality, you know, a spirit pattern. There's another influence from eternity upon which your very energy system rests. That influence from eternity, that is at the center of every automaton, right? The aisle. The influence of the aisle from eternity into time is present at the center of every automaton. It's not experientially there. It's, you know, any more than your personality is an object in time so that it's experientially here. It's not an object in time. You know, neither is that center of every automaton, Isle of Paradise. It's not an object in time. It's an influence from eternity. You know? So that's why that other influence from eternity can, you know, your personality can engage, because it's just the other side of the influence that's already there. It's really the same thing. Okay? So just the statement, evolutionary will creatures, has the potential for a transformative recognition, okay? And that's what we're talking about here. You know, you can get lost in the different arrangements of molecules that they're talking about, you know, what kind of arrangement of molecules makes a non-breather, you know, or whatnot. But remember, that's, you know, it's a very profound thing that we're talking about, something infinitely transcendent of anything that you've ever known is bubbling up into experiential reality. And so it's always going to be filled with mysterious patterns and order that don't seem to be causally understandable from a temporal perspective. You know, we're just about to read about an example of that in the next paragraph. So let's do that.
Before you go on there, yeah. I wanted to talk about the, you know, when I first read this, will dignity of animals or bipeds, mm-hmm. you know, I watched too much Star Trek, I guess, you know, mm-hmm. thinking that beings in another world didn't necessarily walk around. That was kind of interesting mm-hmm. to figure that out. And, you know, it means morals on a planet, not necessarily, you know, Morancha, right? We may or may not be bipeds in a
no, again,
in
we're gonna,
spiritual state, right?
You, no, again, that's what I'm saying. Because, see, it appears that we're going up to a Morontia, but from an existential perspective, you know, we've come down from the Morontia.
But answer my question.
Yeah, as a Morontia being, you'll be a biped. As a spirit being, you'll be a biped on the Isle of Paradise.
Just a different substance.
Right, just made out of a different substance. Right, that's what we were trying to stress last time. You have a creature form, and it's just expressed at different levels, right? And the fact that that's the case is when you find a being that actually has the ability in of its own nature to express itself at different levels. You know, a Melchizedek, when he expresses itself at our level, is a biped. That's not because he was a quadruped as normally as a spirit being.
But
he's a biped as a spirit being.
Divine counselor may not be a biped.
Right? It's very likely that all the, you know, they say almost every creature has a form.
Yeah.
Right? Just a few exceptions. It's very likely they're all of a similar form. I mean, you know, Michael can incarnate as a biped. And that's probably not because it's some sort of a weird disconnect, and there's a lot of magic. I mean, it's just that he's just being expressed down at a lower level. That would be your first assumption, right?
Do you think God's a biped?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's getting way off. You know, I mean, that's not a creature. You know, but you know, I mean, you get your point. I mean, don't you know? You don't want to start with the bar in Star Wars. Right.
That's just what came to mind.
You want to start simpler. You know, allow for some complexity, right? But don't start with, you know, I'll bet you there's even beings like us that aren't animals at all. They're plants, you know, or something. It's like, no, that's not the way it works.
You know what's right? Interesting, Chris? When we were talking about yep. that. You know, when Michael came down here, he starts as a baby, okay? But when he incarnates in the other worlds with the angels, mm-hmm. so he's mm-hmm. not a baby.
No.
So they evidently they don't start as babies then.
Right. I mean, you know, it's only these creatures of will dignity we're talking about here, mortals of will dignity, you know, that start as babies. I mean, remember, even secondary midwares don't start as babies, and they're really close to us in nature, right? They start as adult. You know, those 16 progenitors. You know, did that act that we all think leads to a baby, but it didn't lead to a baby, right? It led to a full-grown adult creature, right, standing there in front of them. You know, so you know, that all just seems so magical, right, to us. And then again, it seems so magical because we're so used to absolutizing our bottom-up perspective, thinking that that's, you know, what that defines reality, you know? And really, it's the other way down. I mean, you have an adult at a higher level that gets expressed as adult at a lower level. I mean, that's more the truth of it, you know? Because a lot of times it's being done in a more eventuated fashion. And so you don't have the nature spread out over time. Yeah. I mean, and like I said, I mean, when two humans conceive a baby, that single-celled animal is just that, a single-celled animal. You know, your child doesn't have to start as a single-celled plant and work its way through to become a single-celled animal. Right? I mean, that whole plant-animal is all bottled up, you know, eventuated into its beginning. But it does start as a single-celled animal, you know, and quickly goes through the essence of evolution from single-celled animals to will creatures between conception and roughly age 6. Right? I mean, don't forget, it's not over at birth. I mean, there's an awful lot of the evolutionary process that happens subsequent to birth. Right? You know, it's only until roughly age 6 that you have all 7 adjutants and you're fully like Anda and Infanta were that one day. Right? So, all right.
So
Okay.
Oh, was there a question here too?
Secondary midwares, you conjectured last time or perhaps the time before that the secondary midwares are normal size. They're not necessarily huge. I always thought of them as large, but then when you think about Adamson and Rata starting out the secondary midwares.
You would assume that a secondary midware is probably greater than 6 foot.
Okay.
Right? That's kind of size. When you see people's, except for the giant strains, you set aside the giant strains for a second, but if there's mortals that are basically greater than 6 foot, that's a pretty good indicator that there's some Adamic blood there. Right? That's kind of, especially if you're, getting to be 7 foot and stuff like that. It's indicating, some upstepping.
Right? No, I understand. The actual birth itself, though, these secondary midwares are full size. They are born.
Right. Again, remember, Adamson and Rata didn't give birth to secondary midwares.
Okay.
Right? Adamson and Rata had a whole bunch of children. Every fourth one was one of those progenitors of the secondary midwares, right? There were 16 of them, 8 boys and 8 girls, right? That then were paired up, right? Right? Those progenitors, were in Rata's womb and were birthed out, right? Just like every child, right? And grew up. But when they were old enough, they gave rise to the secondary midwares, right? The secondary midwares are the grandchildren of Adamson and Rata, not the children.
That's and then
Lyota,
that was the one that Adam was with, right? Was that the name?
Right, yeah, there's
those other issues, right? Yeah. That was an interesting thing.
Right, so
what do you think happened there?
Well, again, we're going kind of far afield here. But just remember, we talked about that the material son and daughter in general are not supposed to be mating with the evolutionary stock because there's too big of a discontinuity. Mm-hmm. Like the mother is not going to survive childbirth. Right? There's too much of a biologic discontinuity. That's why that you need another down step that needs to be the children of the Adam and Eve on a world, that mate. So there's not this biological disconnect, so that there's stresses on the system that the evolutionary creatures can't handle. Right? And if we didn't have a little bit more robust strains because of the Noddites, right, there wouldn't have been anyone on the planet that could have handled mating with our Adam and Eve. Right? Yeah, but those Noddites were kind of quasi-Adamites, right, already, so they could handle it in general. That's why Rata could, didn't have any issues at all, mating with Adamson. But, that's more appropriate, because Adamson is a downstep.
He was having a 6-foot baby that sort of had me.
Right, and again, they're not being birthed. The secondary midwares are not being birthed.
And I understand.
They're just coming into existence in the room, right, as a full-grown creature. Right? Okay.
That seems a little
dangerous. Right, because it's all of that process that we think of as conception, development, birth, more development, that's all eventuated into them. They don't, that part of their nature is not spread out over time. It's all just bottled up into them. See, that right there is proof that the absentite isn't something in the future, right? You couldn't have that. Nothing could have a chunk of time bottled up like that. It would have to start as a single-celled creature and mature into a full-grown secondary midware, right? If it was nothing but the finite. But the fact that things can be bottled up like that all, not spread out over time, that proves that really what we are is a downstepped expression of the absentite. There's eventuation already.
It does mess up your privacy when your kid just shows up like that.
Right, right.
Yeah. So
anyway, okay, so let's go to the next thing here. So
there are 6 basic evolutionary races, 3 primary, red, yellow, and blue, and 3 secondary, orange, green, and indigo. Most inhabited worlds have all of these races, but many of the 3 brain planets harbor only the three primary types. Some local systems have only these three races.
Also, yeah, have only these three races. Okay, so yeah, is before we got off on that last tangent, you know, I was trying to set this up. Okay, reminding you that, you know, you can get very profound expressions of pattern and order that seem to magically come out of nowhere, and that's because you're looking at it from the wrong perspective. You know, you're thinking, you know, everything is bottom up. That really a lot of it is manifestly top down. I mean, the fact that you can get these six colors coming into existence, as you know, where there's no sign of that to begin with, right? To showing you that there's great pattern that's been downstepped, and we're just manifesting that pattern in this temporal process. But the temporal aspect is not primary. That's just an appearance. It's just a secondary issue. Okay, and so you have three primary, three secondary, as we all know. We've studied the book for a long time. Secondaries are going to be darker skinned in general than the primaries. And that whole bit about, most inhabited worlds have all six. But now, you know, we haven't gotten to the three brains. That's coming up in the next section. But just to jump ahead a little bit, the reason that many of the three-brain planets don't have the secondaries is very understandable when you, once you recognize that each one of the six sangic races favors one of the adjutants. You know, they all have all seven, of course, they're humans, right? But they each favor one, and the secondaries are favoring the first three adjutants, you know, those more foundational adjutants. Okay? The three-brained types of humans are manifesting a type of human of a higher nature, fundamentally. You know, and so they just, you know, they're pointing out that a lot of times those three-brainers are literally above the level where you can express a secondary sangic. They're just of a higher nature than those foundational elements that are expressed in the secondary sangics. Okay? So they're not involved in manifesting the differentials between high and low, like we are, for instance. Those three-brainers, a lot of them, are manifesting subtler differentials. The potentials are not as great, you know, in what's being actualized, because it takes every size potential to manifest the supreme. You can't have all the same size potentials being actualized. And then some local systems also have only the three. So the whole local system. See, again, that's just it's telling you that those local systems, are not manifesting, you know, as deep a differential as we are, for instance.
We have eight, right?
So yeah, and then we threw in something that's even deeper, if you will, you know, than the secondary sangics in some ways. You know, it's at a lower level, the Andonites. Now, in other ways, you could say it's actually higher than the Sangics, right? Because it's like a pre-blended race, right? So it's both higher and lower. But, you know, one of the things they were doing on this world is they wanted to maximize the differentials that are going to get actualized. And so having a pre-Sangic will creature was, you know, it's sort of getting a will creature in the most minimal form, right? You can't make one any lower, right? Whereas, like they're pointing out, a three-brainer is not a will creature that's sort of down at the lowest level. It's up off the floor a little bit, you know. So you've got all these differentials. Let's see. Anything else we want to say there? Other than just. You know, if you're used to neo-Darwinism, magic matter, evolutionary thoughts. When you read Red, Orange, Yellow, Green, Blue, Indigo, you go, yeah, right, and you toss the book away. You know that just sounds ridiculous. But to get over that, you've got to start recognizing, that things are really being expressed from the top down. And it's not at all surprising that there might be some sixfold pattern on high that gets downstepped, But why dirt clods would suddenly manifest into six colors of mortals, right, is pretty mysterious and seemingly nonsensical. All right, let's keep going here.
The average special physical sense endowment of human beings is 12, though the special senses of the three-brain mortals are extended slightly beyond those of the one and two-brain types. They can see and hear considerably more than the Arantia races.
That's like material sons and daughters are that way too. So you can see how three-brainers are up a little bit closer to where the prototype is, the material sons and daughters, and having that more extended range. But that kind of throws you for a loop. It does say average, but that the average special, just physical senses, so it's like you can't bring in your ability to sense spirit substance, it's just the physical senses, is 12. Okay, and you say, well, maybe we're on the low end of the average, or maybe you need to think a little bit more about what senses we have. Maybe we don't just have five senses, right? And we're not talking about the direct mindal things. We're talking about physical senses, so not things like extrasensory perception, mind-to-mind sort of linkage stuff. These are physical senses.
And just don't realize it?
And we just don't acknowledge this, haven't fully recognized. Now, one of the things we read about a while back towards the beginning of part two, remember how they talked about, when they're talking about magnetism a little bit? Right? Do you remember that bit about how creatures have little magnetic bodies, within them, and that even humans have that ability? Some, right? I mean, there's a sense of orientation, right? It may not be very definitively expressed or even conscious, in most humans, but they say it is there, right? So, I mean, that's a physical sense. Right. That's not one of the five we always talk about.
Is that the north, south, east, right. West?
Okay. Right. To have a sense of orientation, relative to the magnetic field of the earth, so that you can basically know, north, south, east, west.
Some people can find that.
Right. Some people just kind of very intuitively do it.
Birds have that.
Right. See, now, the other thing to remember is, notice, do you understand why it says special? Physical sense. Okay? I mean, remember that senses are all fundamentally in the mind. Right? Again, it appears like it's in your eyeball or your fingertip or something, but not really. Right? It's really in your mind. Your mind is sensing things, not your body. Your body isn't conscious. It can't sense anything any more than this table can sense something. Right? Your mind is sensing things. Right? So these are... they're telling you on average there's 12 specialized modes of feeling in your mind. I mean, you have a general, everything in the mind is felt. Right? I mean, if your adjuster were to speak to you, you feel that, right? Or or whatever. I mean, everything is a feeling in the mind, but there's specialized feeling, narrowed down to a particular form tied to some sort of a stimulus response related to your physical body, like my eyeballs or those little bits of magnetic material that might be in a cell or the nerve endings in my fingertips.
What can you imagine that would be? I mean, use your imagination. What would be another sense?
Right, well, I was just about to do that. Okay. So, I already gave you one.
Hearing. seeing it.
I gave you the sense of orientation that I told you about. That's obviously, so there's, you know, that makes six in just a simple sense. But again, you know, think about it. You know, there may be things like, you know, with my fingertips, if I put my hand on some, my fingertips on something, there's two things that I immediately might pick up. There's the texture of the surface I'm touching. There's also the temperature.
That's feel,
though. Of the surface I'm touching. Right? So we just say feeling, right? But remember, everything in the mind is feeling, right? So you could ask yourself, are they trying to give you some hints to think about like that? Is there really more than one sense there? I mean, because your mind deciding the temperature of something, the texture of something, that's a pretty different thing, right? Maybe that's, I don't know, right? But even though we might not be at the average, scientists ought to be challenging themselves to think about this more. You know, not think, because right now, our whole notion of senses is biased to the physical, right? We look for holes in our head. It's like, okay, here's two holes, so there's one sense. Here's a hole, my nose, that's another sense. Okay, here's another hole, you know, my mouth, okay, so there's taste. We're thinking so physically about these senses, you know, but that's not what they are. My tongue doesn't taste anything, right? My mind tastes things.
There's the electrical, like when you shock somebody and you're walking, that's a thing. There's the heat when you're doing some kind of healing. Your hand gets hot because you're spiritual.
Or you don't have to do anything fancy. If I stick my finger in.
I'm talking about when you can touch somebody and you can they can feel the heat from. Let's say you're trying to heal somebody.
Yeah. Okay. Fine.
You know what I mean? That's another one.
Wondering if those sorts of things, you know. But again, you don't want to be careful because it's just physical ones, right? I mean, there's a whole bunch of senses, too, that we have. We can feel, our mind can feel stimulation coming in through spiritual stimuli conduits also, right? So you got to separate those that you might be picking up from just the physical ones, right? And again, that's something that humans have never done. Humans have just assumed everything is physical in some way, and if it doesn't seem immediately logical that this thing that they're sensing is physical, then they believe that physical things are magical. I mean, again, we don't really believe in spirit substance right now. No one has ever believed in spirit substance, right? Like when they talk about Adam and Eve, you know, they mention they have their physical senses and their spirit senses, right? I mean, they're actually able to see spirit substance in the external world, right? So they can see a being, you know, that's more made out of spirit substance, right? We can't see that, right? That's a whole nother issue, right? But to try to just keep it to things that seem more immediately tangible, where you can, if it's a special sense, there's something specific in the body, you know, that's related to that. Right? And okay, so anyway, that's what they're getting at.
When they can see a more spiritual being or a higher being, that's an extended vision, so it's still vision, isn't it?
It's not. I mean, to see a Melchizedek, if a Melchizedek was standing right here, it's not because I can see more in the ultraviolet or more in the infrared or something. And I could see all 100 octaves of the electromagnetic spectrum and I couldn't see a Melchizedek. And it has nothing to do with that horizontal increase in the spectrum that they're talking about here that three-brainers have or that Adam and Eve, right? You know, you have to actually be able to see spirit energy in the external world, right? Spirit energy is not, you know, it's not visible in the ultraviolet or the X-ray spectrum or something, right? I mean, it has nothing to do with electromagnetic frequencies. Yeah, if I could hear really, really low frequencies or really, really high frequencies, I could hear a Melchizedek. No, see, it doesn't have anything to do with the change of electromagnetic or sound wave frequency.
So it's extended vertically and not horizontally.
Yeah, vertically, not horizontally. Yeah, right. You know, and at the same time that it's quote unquote extended vertically, I mean, they literally have, a relationship to both substances in the external world.
Yeah.
not just kind of a greater relationship to physical-like energy vertically, or, you know, they also have a direct relationship to spirit substance. Right? Okay. You know, they can see it. You know, they can pick that up. Right? And you're going, well, how does that work? What's the, you know, is it there? They have fancier eyeballs? It's like, no, see, again, you're thinking materially. Right? You know, fancier eyeballs don't allow you to see spirit substance. Eyeballs are made out of matter, right? You've got to actually have something, you know, a spirit-like receptor for a spirit-like fact. Right? You know, they have they're not just blobs of protoplasm like we are. There's more to a material son and daughter than this. You know?
I think Adam and Eve there must be relatively little spirit substance here, at least particularly back when Adam and Eve were here. So they had to have suffered sensory deprivation in a big way.
Yeah, remember that's, you know, the first thing that sets in for them. And normally it's okay because they have their prince and the staff are all there, and there's a rich life that they can, you know, connect with. But our Adam and Eve got here, and, you know, they were basically, you know, heading to default the first night.
Yeah.
Right? Right? I mean, because they're looking and there's nothing to see. You know, except lots of rebel beings, you know. Right? You want to sit there and quietly watch the sunset, and there's Caligastia, you know, making his pitch. Right? You really need to join the rebellion, you know. I mean, it's like, you know, can't you just, like, go away? Right. So, you know, they were immediately disillusioned, you know, and really it was all over the first night. I mean, it's just, it took 100 years to play out, but really they were in default the first night. You know, they lost their patience and integrity the very first night. They didn't last 24 hours, you know, without that stimulus.
I know you said that they disconnected, but if he would have only given some mercy and let them continue on to rather than cut them off so that we all have to suffer, you know, from our inadequacies and not being able to be fully what we were planning.
The greatest affliction is to never have been afflicted.
Yeah, but we're really afflicted.
Right, so you are rich.
That's right.
Right? Remember, beings from planets without rebellion and default enviously look to you. Wow, I wish I had the chance to be on a world of rebellion and fault and stand forth like Amadon did. I mean, but I'll never get that chance, they say, so I have to just be content, you know. I mean, or, boy, I wish I could have been born where I could have really had to struggle with the things lower down, but no, the life carriers made me a three-brainer, you know, and I kind of started, you know, several steps up from where Chris starts on Urantia. You know, and I'll never get to do that lower stuff. It's like, well, everyone has their place. You know, once you discover what place you're in, be content with it, right? We just read that, right? And the wisdom parallels to Moda, right? We're always, oh, the grass is greener on the other side. I wish we were like that. I wish we hadn't had a rebellion and a fall. I mean, right? You'll spend all of eternity doing that because there's always someone different. And if you think of it from your perspective, someone better, right? It's like, no. First shall be last, and the last shall be first. Right? If you think about it as a downstepped expression, you know, you're the greatest manifestation in the universe, not the lowliest. All right. Let's see. We haven't gotten very far. Okay, let's do one other tiny little paragraph.
Young are usually born singly, multiple births being the exception, and the family life is fairly uniform on all types of planets. Sex equality prevails on all advanced worlds. Male and female are equal in mind endowment and spirit status. We do not regard a planet as having emerged from barbarism so long as one sex seeks to tyrannize over the other. This feature of creature experience is always greatly improved after the arrival of a material son and daughter.
And you're going to have issues if you lose them. Okay, so notice, again, remember we're supposed to be, it's not so much about the arrangement of molecules, right? It's more about the intellectual and the spiritual things. And like I tried to point out, it's not just about the arrangement of molecules that give skin color, like in that second paragraph, right? It's about the fact each of them favors this, you know, one of the adjutants, right? It has to do with the intellectual life of those different psychic races. And here again, the giving you some of these basic issues. You know, you say, well, why would they mention multiple births? That has, normally you just have a single birth because fundamentally you are trying to get individuated first in your relationship to the cosmos. But there are exceptions. Some people have the challenge of individuating where they aren't so just naturally individuated. Yeah, they're an identical twin. And they don't get the luxury of starting out just naturally using a separate region in the mind energy system. They're using the same region in the mind energy system their identical twin is. Right? They're basically thinking the same thoughts at the same time. And they have to work to get those thoughts separated. Right? That's going to take a while. They're pointing that out because of the mindal issue, that's fundamentally in play. And the bit about the sexes. Again, not that there's a different arrangement of molecules between men and women. That's trivially obvious. But they want you to think about the mind. Okay, and they tell you the male and female are equal in mind endowment and spiritual status. So the intellectual spiritual thing sort of basically is the same. So you're going, yeah, but aren't there differences? Yeah, what exactly is the difference? They're equal in mind endowment, but are they equal in mind usage? No. Males and females have the same, seven adjutants, but they use them very differently. Right? Especially the lower adjutants that are more immediately related to the huge difference in the arrangement of molecules, right, between the two. Right, first and second adjutant stuff, it's going to have lots of differences. Females use the first adjutant radically different than males use the first adjutant. Right? Females have a maternal instinct, in the first adjutant. Males don't have that. Right? For males and females, because they have equal mind endowment, they both have a paternal instinct. But maternal instinct is different than maternal than paternal instinct, right? Or parental instinct. Right? I mean, and they both have a parental instinct, kind of equally. And females, in addition, have a maternal instinct, and males don't have a paternal instinct.
So what you're saying is that when they refer to in the book about that male and female are basically different species, it's the use of the adjutants that are creating that differential.
Right. The difference in the uses of the adjutants is so great. I mean, it's as if they're a different species, right? The way adjutant mind is working on those two different foundations is so radically different. It's almost like it's attuning to two different species.
I don't agree with that at all.
But the point is, is to distinguish between parental instinct, right, which humans have. Some animals do too, but humans really have that quite definitively and quite equally, a parental instinct. Okay. But you can see the big this whole issue of maternal and paternal instinct. We're coming up from the animals, and there's a big difference in the animal world, right? Right. I mean, a lot of male animals, right? Just like nothing there.
Kill the young in a second.
Right. Right, and so you don't want to over idealize humans, right? It's not an abomination to have males and females be that radically different. That's the whole point. If males were as bound to their first adjutant as females are, the human species would die off in short order. It wouldn't survive. Saber-toothed tigers would eat all the humans, and it would be the end of the humans. Right?
Sorry.
Right? You've got to have that differential. The male can't have that much identification to the first adjutant. He's going to be too place-like. There's no way he can be that directional, influence. Right? It doesn't mean that there aren't some males, especially more, less primitive males, that can be quite, enlightened in their relationship to children. But, we're not, Andonites, right? If you went back and observed Andonites, right, you wouldn't see any of this civilizational overlay. Right? I mean, a lot of things that we do that seem so genetic aren't genetic at all. And that's one of the most important things that the marriage and family papers try to bring out. Try to get you to separate what things are cultural and what things are genetic. And there's some of the statements they make in there, will just boggle your mind. Things they tell you that have no genetic nature at all, and that everyone believes is you have no control over because it's just purely genetic, like jealousy. Jealousy has no biologic originator. You just impose that on yourself. There's no source for that biologically. No matter how basal that seems, it doesn't have a biologic source. There's lots of things like that, right? And so if you see someone with a paternal instinct, a male with it just appears to be a paternal instinct. They're imposing that on themselves. It can be indistinguishable from the maternal instinct, but there's a fundamental difference. The maternal instinct is not just self-imposed. That's just biologic.
So the paternal is more volitional.
Right, right. Or, if it's not literally volitional, it's, you are asserting yourself in that way because you want to identify with the mores or whatever, right? But just to appreciate that, they're trying to teach us not that we don't have profound aspects, but to get us to appreciate the difference. You can't expect a male to be as biologically there as a female is. Right, and so that gets us back to this whole bit about you haven't emerged from barbarism so long as a sex seeks to tyrannize over the other. Okay, because the way this planet rolls has been rolling for a long time, right? It's women trying to have some equality in a social context, trying to liberate themselves from some tyranny by males. But the solution to males tyrannizing females is not females tyrannizing males because they deserve it, right? You're just extending the barbaristic state of mankind, as a female. Remember, that's the challenge they give in the marriage and family papers to females. It's like, okay, you finally have the opportunity. Are you going to blow it? Are you just going to turn the tables and say that you now deserve to be the tyrannical one for the next 15 centuries? Because we deserve it, we males, right? I mean, do you really want to perpetuate the barbarism of mankind for centuries and centuries? No, right? You got to let go of the dichotomy. Females don't deserve reparations for centuries of tyranny or something like this, right? You can't think that way. Right? So that they're trying to they're bringing up that whole thing. You see, each of these tiny little paragraphs is a window into a big space. And we've talked about a lot of that male-female stuff a lot. And yes, that is completely. A lot of that is completely not politically correct. You've been trained probably since you were a little child to not believe such things. That's the conflict you're looking for in the fifth epical revelation. You make an effort to study it, You struggle and struggle trying to wrap your mind around it. You finally start to recognize what it's saying, and you find a conflict. Right now, you've gotten to the starting point. You know, something that challenges your current worldview. That's revelation. Something that affirms your worldview is not revelation. That's affirmation. Right? So that's what you're looking for. Yep.
What is the defining place when someone is so afflicted in their opinion and attitudes, their judgments, like you said, jealousy, those types of things, that is there a point where their mind endowment has to have some components so that they can, they either can or can't genetically come out, you know, come up out of it, or
the I mean, you got two things in play. Because we didn't get the full biologic uplift, there's a lot of individuals that just don't have the capacity for anything too profound in the way of behavior. And there's really no solution to that. But you don't want to underestimate actually using the will. You know, the title of this section is Will Creatures. Right, and I've spoken to that several times, you know, in recent weeks. I mean, that yes, you've got a lot of biologic issues, or you may. But don't underestimate actual exercising of your personality. Not just following your genetics, but getting above your genetics and choosing to take a hold of it and saying, yes, my genetics would have this response to that stimulus, but that's not the way I'm going to respond.
To get to that point for someone who's so stuck in their judgments and their,
right.
they just can't get it.
Right, again. I mean, they're, you know.
You pray for them.
You're right.
Yeah.
You can, right. I mean, it's not going to happen magically. You know. I mean, usually people don't bring in that exercise of will until they've gotten all the way down in the gutter. You know, like let's say it's a guy and he's on a self-destructive track. You know, he loses his job because of his self-destructive behavior. He loses his family, you know, his wife and kids leave him. You know, he loses his house, he loses all his money, he's got nothing. You know, he's literally laying in the gutter, you know, with some rags on, you know, laying in his own feces. That tomorrow he'll die, or... You know, when he finally hits bottom, you know, the blow to his head is hard enough when it finally slams on the bottom, and he recognizes I'm at a choice point. Right? And men take two tracks when they get to that point. They either die the next day or they pull themselves up finally. They finally exercise free will. Grab a hold of their mind grabs a hold of their molecules, and they lift themselves up out of the gutter. But it usually takes that, you know, if they're on some sort of a drug or alcohol abuse track, I mean, usually they don't turn around until they hit rock bottom like that, you know, and that's just the sad state we're in. I mean, it takes the full differential for a lot of people to finally open their eyes. You know, they can't pick up on the first subtle little thing. You know, they can't learn by looking and saying, you know, if I did that, I'm going to lose my job, and then I'm going to lose my family. You know, they can't look forward like that. They have to actually go through the whole spectrum of experience all the way to rock bottom before they finally wake up. And this is the way it is. All right. You can try to help them. You can try to pray for them, etc., but don't be surprised if they have to go through the full spectrum of experience as an individual before they turn around or die. Right, and then if the next day is death, well, you pick up where you left off in the first imagined world, right? Even someone that pitiful, that limited, was given a thought adjuster by grace, has a soul by grace. That little embryonic soul wasn't on that self-destructive track. The mortal mind that died and doesn't resurrect was on that track. that little embryonic soul is still a little child, innocent child of God. Right? And it'll start up on the first mansion world as an innocent child of God. All right. Okay. Next here.
Seasons and temperature variations occur on all sunlighted and sun-heated planets. Agricultural is universal on all atmospheric worlds. Tilling the soil is the one pursuit that is common to the advancing races of all such planets.
Okay, just a little quick comment. So they're giving you these little things. So they're reminding you that it's important to have the vicissitudes. Right? Evolutionary life needs to be stimulated, prodded forward. You need seasons and temperature variations in order for will creatures to evolve and keep advancing, developing. So you can tell that if it isn't literally going to be because of we have an axis that's tilted, right? So that we have the four seasons because of that axis tilt. If the world that they're going to put put life on and evolve the will creatures didn't have an axis tilt like that, it's going to have something. It's going to have an orbit that's not so circular. Or, you know, it would need to have, you know, multiple suns, or maybe it's a moon, you know, going around, you know, so there's that variation as the moon orbits the planet, you know, and then the planet goes around the sun, or what, you know, they're pointing out that there has to be some sort of variations, unless it's a non-breather world, say, right, then you don't have to have that. But if it's a, you know, if it's a normal sort of world that we think of, that's a little tidbit that it's got seasons and temperature variations. Again, oh, isn't that just about physical? No. Again, what's the point? Your mind needs that challenge, right? Humans only got going here because coincidentally, quote unquote, right, there was a glacial age that those early humans had to deal with, right? They tell you that's not a coincidence. That's the giant cattle prod to get humans to, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. Or, you know, I'm cold. Maybe I should invent better clothing, right? Or whatever, right? Or maybe I need to think about agriculture and saving up food. And okay, I mean, we were talking about this with the non-breathers. Okay, there's a non-atmospheric world. A little hard to have agriculture, right? Right. A little hard to have plants if you don't have water, air, or sun. You got the dirt, but you're kind of missing those other four key ingredients. And you guys all remember how they point out how important tilling the soil is, you know, to the evolution of mankind. And that's why they say it's common to all advancing races. It's a very indispensable part of our evolution, that intimacy with the soil, you know. And you go, well, why? Well, why do we call ourselves humans? Why do we call ourselves up from the humus creatures? Right? We recognized this a long time ago, and what we call ourselves, that reminds us of what we are. It gets us connected to that, grounded, and that we're lifting ourselves up from that soil. That's fundamentally what we are, the truth of what we are. Okay?
Mortals all have the same general struggles with microscopic foes in the early days, such as you now experience on Urantia, though perhaps not so extensive. The lengths of life varies on the different planets from 25 years on the primitive worlds to near 500 on the more advanced and older spheres.
Just because a lot of you are probably thinking about when they bring up, the microscopic issue there. Up in part three, you may recall, those of you who are familiar, and they talk about life, evolution, vicissitudes. I'll just, you know, but throughout all of this biologic adventure, our greatest disappointment, you know, the life carriers, grew out of the reversion of certain primitive plant life to the pre-chlorophyll levels of parasitic bacteria on such an extensive and unexpected scale. See, they used that extensive word again there.
We didn't do anything about it because we thought...
But remember, what that paragraph goes on, it's like the life carriers thought it was going to be okay because we were going to get the full biologic uplift from Adam and Eve. Oops. All right. So now we've got all these
Welcome to the decimal.
problematic bacteria and
tomorrow, what you can do today.
And viruses. But you know, just again, okay, it seems like just a physical issue. Okay, so every planet's got to struggle with bacteria that cause disease. It's like, well, why would God do that? Why would God, you know, I can understand maybe rebellion and default or something like that. So, yeah, you know, no, every world, God subjects them to death from bacteria. Why? Because you need that challenge. Now, see, mortals all have the same general struggles. Effort, struggle, conflict. It's part of your mindal development. Every world has to have those vicissitudes, those challenges. You don't have to have them as extreme as some worlds end up having them, but every world has to face that.
The progress without them.
Right. Pain and suffering are essential to progressive evolution. Right.
If the bacon wasn't sizzling on the stove, you wouldn't get up in the morning.
let's see, was there anything else? Oh, yeah, we got to talk about the... Right, so we talked about this way back somewhere, this whole bit about the length of life. And I talked about it way back then. When the life or the revelators are talking about the length of life, life expectancy is... not what they're, you know, interested in. You know, life expectancy is you in relationship to the environment, what ends up being the average lifespan. Right? What they're always telling you about is, you know, independent of environmental issues, like bacteria, right? If there's a lot of bacterial issues and you haven't gotten the science to deal with them yet, it's going to shorten the life expectancy. Right? Independent of those issues of the environment, just genetically, you know, what's your average lifespan? That, in other words, not life expectancy, but longevity. What's your longevity? That's what they're talking about here. And you know, we all kind of remember that you get way advanced and you got like a 500-year longevity on worlds. But notice how short it is on some worlds to start with the primitive humans, 25 years. That should remind you of, you know, it seemed like our, like we were just saying, our Andonites are lower than Sangiks, and so you'd think, you know, they would have even shorter life. You know, lifespans like that, you know, shorter longevities. But do you even remember what they tell you about the Andonites? What their longevity was?
Oh, 75.
Wow, I do know. All right. Maybe they aren't as lowly as... Right, see, this is another... See, like I said, are they higher or lower? It depends on how you look at it. Right?
Very few got there, but
Right. So you start with the 75 on this planet. If you get some back mating, you know, you get an average of like 70. Get a little upstepping, you get an average like 80, and there's the Bible passage. Right? 70 or by reason of strength, if you got some biologic uplift, some andite in you, 80. Right? You start with 75, and it just goes 5 years one way or another, and that's our basic longevity range, depending on how much back mating or how much uplifting there is in your genetics.
What book of the Bible is that
in? What was that?
Where is that in the Bible?
Oh, let's see. That's in Leviticus, I think, maybe?
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very ancient thing, you know. It goes, you know, I mean, as soon as the Andites really blended in, it's been in that range ever since. You know, still today, basically our longevity is that. Our life expectancy keeps going up, but our longevity hasn't really changed. And, you know, the average, you know, that average genetic lifespan. Okay, so that's what they're talking about there.
Human beings are all gregarious, both tribal and racial. These group segregations are inherent in their origin and constitution. Such tendencies can be modified only by advancing civilization and by gradual spiritualization. The social, economic, and governmental problems of the inhabited worlds vary in accordance with the age of the planets and the degree to which they have been influenced by the successive sojourns of the divine sons.
I mean, all I want to do is just point out, I mean, fundamentally, which adjutant are they talking about? You know, so when we're talking about these basic intellectual issues, which adjutant is the foundational element for that gregarious nature?
Council.
The fifth, right, yeah. Spirit of council, you know, right. Or the energy of socialization, right? Yeah, here the fifth adjutant, you look on the chart there. Right, so they're just making a little comment about that. That's the peak of animals, so that's kind of the beginning of humans in a more exalted fifth adjutant phenomenon. You know, and so that, you know, think about how that makes sense. Human beings are all gregarious, right? It's just a very foundational thing, that fifth adjutant manifesting. And the only way that, you know, it's going to change, like they're pointing out, is through choice, right? If we just let ourselves be our mind that's attuned to our genetics, we're going to continue to be tribal and racial forever, right? Advancing civilization. Civilization is a choice, right? And we all know there's a civilizational emergency in play. Fewer and fewer humans are choosing to be something besides what they are naturally. They're not choosing to be an art form anymore that's civilized, right? And so that's why more and more everything is just becoming tribal again, right? America is just awash in a growing tribalism in every sector, right? The tribalism that is, a two-party system will just get all the more tribal. Sports are tribal, and, you know, everything's tribal. Everyone's trying to create their tribe on the internet, you know, and everything is tribal, right? That's because there's no human quality anymore. It's just what we are naturally as a fancy animal, right? And if you are just going to let yourself be tribal by nature, well, you're not the beginnings of a mastered self that is a nation, where you might get help from the angels of nation life, right? If you're tribal, you don't get any help from the angels of nation life. They aren't the angels of tribal life, right? If you want a more advanced help, you have to choose to be more advanced. God helps those who help themselves, right? God's helpers, the angels of nation life, are a simple example of that. So those things. See, again, they're pointing out some of the basic, you know, intellectual aspects of mortals. Let's see, anything else there? And we'll get to the, remember there's a whole paper in this block about inhabited worlds on the successive ages, right, that they're talking about there. All right.
Mind is the bestowal of the infinite spirit and functions quite the same in diverse environments. The mind of mortals is akin, regardless of certain structural and chemical differences, which characterize the physical natures of the will creatures of the local systems. Regardless of personal or physical planetary differences, the mental life of all these various orders of mortals is very similar, and their immediate careers after death are very much alike.
Okay, so what's the main point they're trying to get in there? Why did they emphasize right up front, mind is the bestowal of the infinite spirit? Why do they bring that in? I'm trying to remind you again, even though we're talking a lot about, you know, mind is attuned to the genetics and therefore differences in genetics, like different sangic race or whatever, you know, or male or female, has a lot to do with how that adjutant mind is used. Mind doesn't bubble up out of the matter. Mind is an energy system that's absolutely separate from the matter. It's coming down from the third source and center as the mind bestower, has an absolute complexity and fluidity in and of itself. It can adjust to a lot of different situations. See, like they're just saying, all these physical variations. But the mind of mortals is akin, regardless of certain structural and chemical differences. Right? No matter how much difference there is, all seven adjutants can engage. Right? And that's because that creativity, if you will, of that absolute being on high reaching down with mind, can adapt to any situation, can get that mind to you. May take some time. Remember how it took a long time for the adjutants to really kind of get seated here, because we're a decimal world. But they're reminding you of that independence. And so, again, even without will, like we were talking about, you know, will being able to overcome some of these genetic issues eventually. There's just mind over matter. You know, before there's spirit over mind, there's mind over matter too. Mind may be a lot like the matter right down at the bottom, but if you get up a little ways in the mind, it's not so like the matter. Right? The higher you go, the more it's like the infinite spirit. Right? Which doesn't have any defects like your matter does. Right? So they're just reminding you of that basic fact. There's an absolutely separate source. So it's pure at its source. And so you can move up and just use higher levels of mind and get above the physical issues. Let's see. And then that last little thing they mentioned at the end there, remember that most of the stuff we're talking about is left behind in the next, the next life, right? Because you don't have an agitated mind attuned to matter in the next life. So all these physical differences and whatnot, are not an issue. Right? You've got a Marancha body, Marancha mind, and it's a totally separate issue. So their immediate careers after death are very much alike. All right, what else do they say here?
But mortal mind, without immortal spirit, cannot survive. The mind of man is mortal. Only the bestowal spirit is immortal. Survival is dependent on spiritualization by the ministry of the adjuster, on the birth of the evolution of the immortal soul. At least there must not have developed an antagonism towards the adjuster's mission of effecting the spiritual transformation of the material mind.
Okay, so the paragraph starts with but. Even though, there's this glorious, perfect, infinite, absolute source for mind on high, that doesn't mean that your adjutant mindal self is immortal. Right? When you downstep mind that far, you can't make an inherently immortal self. Right? A Marancha mind is not downstepped as far. It inherently is immortal. But remember, until fusion, okay, you have free will control over that mind. You can still choose to shut it off, as it were. But just of its own nature, it's immortal, even though you aren't technically immortal yet because you haven't gotten fusion yet. Okay? So they're reminding you of that when mind is downstepped all the way down to the adjutant level, despite the divinity of the source, that mind is mortal just like your body is mortal. That mind is subject to the mortality of your body, to things just slowly unraveling. Okay? No adjutant mindal self is resurrected. It's a mortal mindal self. So like they're saying, the only way that you can go on is if the higher parts of your agitant mind, the spiritualized parts, like they're talking about there, that the adjuster is catalyzing the existence of, that spiritualized mind in the upper domain of the hourglass, you know, that's copied, you know, as a Marantia self, which is innately immortal, even though it isn't, you know, literally so, because it hasn't fused with an adjuster yet. Right, so they're just reminding you of that. Yep.
As you said earlier.
Yep.
Look at it from where it really began, it already fused with an
adjuster. Right, so, right.
Sorry.
But no, it's an important thing to bring down, you know. I mean, just, again, to appreciate that, you know, it starts at the top as an immortal fact. I mean, eternity is immortality, right? And you downstep that, and it literally is still kind of inherently there. Even when you get all the way down to the kind of mind that can be seated on your little embryonic soul, but you take it down one more notch, and then that connection to eternity is severed. It's not inherently connected to eternity from the top down anymore. You know, it's only, you know, kind of from the bottom up, and it's a very indirect thing. Just again to appreciate that, you know, that the adjuster is coming from the top down, and you've got to get up to it, and it can only come down so far. It obviously can't penetrate way down to a level that's mortal, right? I mean, there's no relationship. It's an inherently immortal fact, right? So it can only penetrate down so far. It, you know, in the hourglass analogy, it can't get down there in the lower domain of the hourglass where you're thinking about my words and listening to me right now, right? It can only get down into that upper domain. You can't get down any further. It would cross that threshold to below which there's anything it can relate to, okay? Let's see. And that last little comment, right, I think everyone picked that up, but, you know, at least there must not have developed an antagonism towards the adjuster's mission. You know, we've had lots of, you know, for millennia, humans have tried to figure out what actions that humans do make it so that you don't survive. You know, and there was some truth to that sort of stuff prior to Pentecost, but now everyone gets a thought adjuster by grace. Right, so now, I mean, you've got a soul by grace. You'll survive. Unless you can actually rise up and not just have an antagonism against the doctrines of some evolutionary religion, right? You've got to have a real antagonism in order to have any effect on that soul that you now have by grace. Right? I mean, obviously before, if you had a very antagonistic mind, it would never get up to third circler and never get an adjuster, never have a soul. But that's not, that physics is not in place anymore. Now you're just given a soul by grace. Right? And, you know, as hard as it was for you before to get up from seventh circular to third circular, it's that hard for you to get up to any point where you could have any impact on that soul. Right? An ignorant seventh circular, you know, sixth circular, whatnot, with all of this goofy notions in your head and stuff, you know, you may call yourself an atheist, say, right? But that's not the real God that you're against. It's some imaginary God that you're against. That doesn't have any impact on your soul. Right? Right? Some juvenile, primitive God notion, you can be antagonistic to that until you're blue in the face. That doesn't have any impact on your soul. I mean, you know, remember, sin is not deliberate disloyalty to false notions of God. Right? Sin is deliberate disloyalty to deity. Right, I mean, you've got to get up to the level where you're actually relating to the reality of deity for there to be any impact on your soul. So they're just reminding you that, that now, I mean, as long as you aren't actively antagonistic to the God nucleus within you, you know, which is not a blob of religious doctrine, right? It's a fragment of deity. you know, you're not going to be even close to getting up high enough to damage your soul. And, you know, that's why the revelers say, you can take your salvation for granted, right? Salvation is not an issue anymore, right? So that thing that religionists have thought the only reason that you need a religion for, that's not an issue anymore, right? Take your salvation for granted. If you're going to have a religion, you got to think of something besides salvation to talk about. It's just not an issue anymore. What's the purpose of religion if it's not to give you a doctrine of salvation? You got to ask yourself that question, right? What's the point of it?
Well, random. Slogans are
You might go to the last paragraph of paper 16, section 6, and see what it says about the purpose of religion. Anyway, let's continue on here. So
let's go to 16.
You can't just drop that.
The people. I'm not dropping it. That's their homework. Okay, so now we're going to pick up a little bit more on some of this other physical stuff that they were hinting at, like I said, in the at the end of section 2. Okay.
Section 5, the planetary series of mortals. It will be somewhat difficult to make an adequate portrayal of the planetary series of mortals because you know so little about them, because there are so many variations. Mortal creatures may, however, be studied from numerous viewpoints, among them, among which are the following. 1. Adjustment to planetary environment. 2. Brain type series. 3. Spirit reception series. 4. Planetary mortal epics. 5. Creature kinship serials. 6. Adjuster fusion series. 7. Techniques of terrestrial escape.
So the whole point is just, there's all kinds of patterns, like I was saying, that are being downstepped. And they're just giving us a little taste of that. There's all kinds of different ways that you can survey all the different mortals that are laid out in front of you in the universe of universes, and you can notice patterns. It's like you look at it like this, oh, there's a pattern. You look at it like, you know, from another direction, oh, there's another pattern. And there's just endless different ways that it's not random, right? That it expresses order. It's just this multi-dimensional order, no matter how you look at it. And the bigger the picture you have, the more you can see, oh, that's not just some little thing. There's actually some sort of a pattern there when you look across all seven super universes. Huh, there's some curious thing going on where they seem to be parts of some greater whole. Right? That's what they're trying to get you to appreciate. There's a lot of different spectrums. There's a lot of different ways that the whole gets spread out and appears to be disjoint parts. But the more you can step back and see the whole picture, the more you can recognize, for instance, like the color spectrum, you know, all comes together as white light. The wholeness of white light, you know, separated into a spectrum of colors. Right? There's a wholeness in the cosmos that's embodied in the universal mother, right? There's a wholeness in the cosmos that gets downstepped and spread out into spectrums of different types, you know, and you can marvel at this vast sweeping order across these various spectrums, you know, and it reminds you that that no matter how much it seems like a disjoint set of parts, it's obviously not. You know, the fact that there's a whole is manifest in the coordination of the parts, or the pattern, you know, of that partness. Proof that there's a whole. All right.
The inhabited spheres of the seven super universes are peopled with mortals who simultaneously classify in some one or more categories of each of these seven generalized classes of evolutionary creature life. But even these general classifications make no provisions for such beings as mid-Sniders, nor for certain other forms of intelligent life. Inhabited worlds, as they have been presented in these narratives, are peopled with evolutionary mortal creatures, but there are other forms, other life forms.
Just the one little thing they're picking up, that's way back, remember in the beginning of paper 36, we're talking about the life carriers. Do you remember how we saw some hints at diversities of life that they weren't going to talk about? You know, very curious things, different types of planets even, you know, and the life that's attached to them. And that's what they're reminding us here. You know, they're giving us lots of variations here, but it's nothing close to the full spectrum. Right? I mean, even when you're talking about something like midsoniters, you know, they point out, nor for certain other forms. Right, so they tell you about midsoniters, but there's apparently all kinds of other things that are kind of in that mode. Or they tell us about non-breathers. But there's all kinds of other things that are kind of really extreme like that too, that they don't talk about at all. Right? So just remind yourself of that. You know, there's a lot of that diversity is going to have to do with those six other schemes. Right? The ascension scheme is the only thing that's really being talked about in this book. And so only beings that have some immediate relationship to that scheme are talked about in this book. So some of that diversity is related to those other schemes, whatever the heck they are.
And eventually, there will be all the diversity that can exist.
Yeah.
And all.
Every way, shape, and form somehow gets expressed somewhere, at some time. Yeah. All right, so that's just the little fun thing that they're tossing in there, is just to remind you of that incredible diversity.
That's just the finite.
Yeah.
Look at all the triadities you're doing.
Yeah.
Forget about haven't seen diversity yet.
Right. Throw in another 18 triadities, and then you'll have diversity. Yeah. Right. I mean, this is just with the two finite triadities. So. Yeah. All right.
So one adjustment to planetary environment. Excuse me. There are three general groups of inhabited worlds. From the standpoint of the adjustment of creature life to the planetary environment, the normal adjustment group, the radical adjustment group, and the experiential adjust group.
And experimental.
Experimental, right.
Yeah. All I need to say there is just, see, this is most directly what some of the stuff they were hinting back in item number 7, the unnamed types, is in item number 1 here. Okay.
Normal adjustments to planetary conditions follow the general physical patterns previously considered. The worlds of the non-breathers typify the radical or extreme adjustment, but other types are also included in this group. Experimental worlds are usually ideally adapted to the typical life forms, and on these decimal planets, the life carriers attempt to produce beneficial variations in the standard life designs. Since your world's an experimental planet, it differs markedly from its sister sphere in Satania. Many forms of life have appeared on Urantia that are not found elsewhere. Likewise, are many common species absent from your planet.
Okay, so that last little bit, it's a fun little teaser. The one, you notice they mentioned, just like I said, I mean, it's not just non-breathers that are extreme. There's apparently all kinds of other extreme types. Who knows what they are? And then bringing up the bit about the decimal world. Remember as we were, they said normal adjustments to planetary conditions follow the general physical patterns previously considered. Right, I mean, they're harking you back to section 2, right? Those things we considered. And we noticed that when you had a simple little kind of bell curve-like distribution, say relative to atmosphere or gravity, our planet was right in the middle, of that symmetric distribution. And you go, well, why exactly? Well, they just explained to you, right? For experimental worlds, they pick one that's in the middle of those distributions so that you don't have the stresses that result from being away from the center of the bell curve either direction. You've got an environment that's very very naturally pleasant for evolution. You don't want that to be the issue in play, because you want to loosen the constraints on the life a little bit. You know, and if you loosen the constraints, you don't want an aggressive and too aggressive an environment. So you pick this very idyllic sort of, you know, in the center of the spectrum environment, and then you loosen the constraints on the genetics a bit. So they're giving you why it is that we ended up in the middle like that so much. It's because we're a decimal world. We were picked that way to be a decimal world. And let's see, anything else in there? No, that's... just that. I mean, roughly every 10th world is a decimal world. That's why I call it decimal worlds. And it's not precisely 10, but, roughly 10, every 10. We have 619, inhabited worlds right now. So we have 62... Okay, decimal worlds in Satania, they tell you. There's 61 besides us. See, so you can see 620. Yeah, okay, 619 is close. So they're just pointing out all the ones that aren't those other 61, this, our sister spheres, are going to differ markedly. Right, they're going to have this very tight genetic nature that's very precisely attuned to the environment. You know, the environment may, have a lot of variability, right? But the genetic life is just kind of very precisely attuned to that specific environment. And so it doesn't have the option of kind of branching off on all sorts of squirrely tangents like our life has. Right? It's held very tightly constrained, and it has the luxury of flying off on squirrely tangents because it's right in the middle. So if you go off, the environment doesn't kill it instantly.
Right? So our gene. Oh,
oh yeah, gene. Yeah, just saying, gene's gone.
The last little thing there, many forms of many common species are absent from the planet.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a challenge to us to try to figure out what kind of creatures don't we have.
Mm-hmm.
And if,
intelligent.
well, maybe we're deficient, have a more tenuous relationship with certain of the adjutants.
Exactly.
The lack of these species.
See, you're keeping in mind what I told you to keep in mind up front. I was just going to mention that. See, even though we're kind of picking up on that loose end physical thing from section 2, that's what you want to be thinking, right? About this is more about the intellectual spiritual. Right, so, I mean, if they say likewise are many common species absent from your planet, right, I mean, if things are very tightly constrained, they aren't just sort of, well, that's a whatever species on a normal world, right? I mean, it's basically they only have the species they need to kind of properly have the adjutants seated so that that functions in humans in a very precise, balanced, grounded way. Oh, if you toss out some of those common seats for the adjutant mind in the animals, well, that's a challenge. So when all is said and done, God's hands, and so God is saying, try to think with this. what if I give you adjutant mind that isn't very firmly grounded? Can you hold your sanity? Right? There's going to be a lot less tendency for psychological disorders and insanity and stuff on a normal world. But you punch a couple big holes in the foundation for adjutant mind, right? You might just go down the drain somewhere in that, holy floor, right? So that's the implications of what they're getting at.
That's the hole we strike step with readily.
And the key thing there is common species, right? I mean, I mean, every world is going to have kind of an uncommon species because all those variations, you know, some worlds will allow us certain species that another environment wouldn't allow. But the normal ones all have these common ones, and the whole point really of having animals, once you've got humans, it's like, well, why don't we just get rid of the animals? We finally, the scaffolding has done its job, right? It's gotten us up to humans. Why don't you just get rid of the animals and just have humans on the planet? It's like, no, you still need the animals, at least some of them, for the adjutant mind to be seated on an ongoing basis. Okay.
You say elsewhere, do they mean like elsewhere?
They're just, you know, immediately they're just wanting you to think about the other 618 inhabited worlds in Satania. You know? I mean, obviously you could expand it to everywhere too, but you know, they told us that you have basically all the diversity just with those 619. And you don't have to go to the first super universe and, you know, whatever. You know, all those atmospheric types and elemental types and all that sort of stuff, you know, are basically represented. You know, yeah.
Okay. In the universe of Nebadon, all the life modification worlds are serially linked together and constitute a special domain of designated administrators.
No, you skipped her.
And of universe affairs, which is given attention by designated administrators. And all of these experimental worlds are periodically inspected by a corps of universe directors, whose chief is the veteran finaliter known as in Satania as Tabamantia.
Yeah, so if you're reading sequentially, you know, Tabamantia makes his appearance here. We'll get back to him in the next paper, at the end of the next paper. But for those of you who are, you know, longtime students of the book, you go, oh, there's Tabamantia. Right, he's that finaliter, one, you know, that is in charge of this particular spectrum throughout Nebadon, not just in Satania, but throughout Nebadon. I mean, they're every roughly tenth within a local system, but as each local system gets in every roughly every tenth decimal world, experimental world, there's people like Tabamantia who are looking at the big picture, you know, and they see a pattern that's much more profound than just roughly every tenth world. It's not just a numerology thing, right, if you will. They see some interesting pattern that develops across the whole local universe as each local system is kind of doing its own thing. Coincidentally, a pattern starts to form, a spectrum starts to develop. You know, and there's a series, see this, as they're saying, are serially linked together across the whole local universe. And it has something mysterious to do with that, again, that footprint of the whole. The fact that the universe of universes isn't just a collection of parts. It isn't just a universe of universes. It's also one grand universe with one individuality of that whole. Right? And so, you know, the finaliters have a lot to do with supremacy, kind of tending to us moving towards the next age, moving towards supremacy. See, and so being in charge of those expressions of the individuality of the whole finite, you know, the universal mother, manifesting in a very mysterious pattern that begins to develop amongst all the parts.
Would you call it unique?
That's kind of part of the mystery of it. Remember how each local system is tied to a unique Havona world. That would tend you to think that each local system would kind of just be a little island of pattern unto itself. But no, you start to see something is transcending the differences between the Havona worlds. Something greater than just expressing the whole Havona world is happening out here. So again, which is higher, the Havona worlds or our worlds? Right? We're manifesting at something that's transcendent of the home, you know, that complete difference, you know, absolute difference between the Havona worlds. Right? And these, this, You know, so the finaliters, like the Abhimanyasi, are working with that manifestation of that which transcends the central universe that's beginning to show forth here.
I just picture a convention of life carriers and the featured speaker is Abhimanyu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, you know, to just, you know, Abhimanyu is one time a blob of protoplasm like you, sitting on some world, right? Now, he's the sovereign of the experimental worlds in Nebadon, right? Sovereign, right? I mean, he's doing things that are, he's in charge of things that are transcendent of Michael, in Michael's local universe, right? Because Michael is just sovereign of a part. He's not sovereign of the whole grand universe. He doesn't embody the big picture, the big picture.
Now, each Havona world is a pattern world.
Mm-hmm.
For the worlds within the seven super universe, what about the other four outer space? Are they?
We have no idea how it's going to work in the outer space levels. Who knows? All we know now is one Havona world gets expressed as seven local systems,
correct,
one in each super universe. You know that, you know, they tell you that there are seven segments in the outer space levels, that are an absentite expression of the finite seven segments from the seven master spirits in the super universe level. Because remember that the master spirits don't just embody supremacy, they also embody ultimacy, right? So their sevenfoldness is going to, it gets expressed in the four outer space levels as much as it gets expressed, you know, in the finite supremacy ceiling of the super universe level, right? You know that much, but, you know, beyond that, we don't know anything.
I never thought of that.
And the Revelators don't even know that. I mean, the Revelators have no idea how the first outer space level is going to be organized. Yeah, Michael doesn't know. I mean, no one knows, right? Except the master architects, right?
They're not talking.
Right. Except for the beings where that's not something in the future. That's something that's already present, right? From the eternity viewpoint, the fourth outer space level and the other three are complete. And again, time is not an absolute reality. Time is just an appearance from our perspective. Oh, is there something? Oh, no, okay. Let's see. Yep. Let's see. How much time? Yeah, we got time at least for number two here, I think.
Two brain type series. The one physical uniformity of mortals is the brain and nervous system. Nevertheless, there are three basic organizations of the brain mechanism: the one, the two, and the three brain types. Your ancients are of the two brain type. Somewhat more imaginative, adventurous, and philosophical than the one-brain mortals, but somewhat less fit spiritual, ethical, and worshipful than the three-brained orders. These brain differences characterize even the pre-human animal existences.
Okay, so we need to kind of tee it up. We'll talk a little bit about this first paragraph at length. This is a pretty fun thing in the book. Fact that there's one, two, and three brained, and you can see what they're talking about is that our two hemispheres are more precisely two brains that are working together. And so on the one brain worlds, I mean, they've got a cerebrum, you know, essentially like us, except it, you know, it isn't split into two hemispheres. They just have a single, a cerebral cortex, right, rather than one that's bifurcated like ours is. And then they'll tell you in a minute here that on the three-brained, I mean, you've got the two like we have, and then, you know, the cerebellum, you know, effectively, is a much more sophisticated fact, and that's the quote-unquote third brain. Right, so that primitive, you know, brain that we have, the cerebellum, you know, is a more advanced thing, on those.
More developed.
Right, more, you know, more like, you know, one of our hemispheres in terms of its complexity and abilities. Okay. So that's the basic issue, but what are they getting at up front here? We need to understand the basic pattern that's in play. So when they say that the two brain type are somewhat more imaginative, adventurous, and philosophical than the one brain mortals. Okay, the very fact that they say philosophical should get you thinking. It's like, wait a minute, philosophy is a super additive consequence of a relationship between two things. Oh yeah, we kind of already have that sense that there's a bit of a differential between the two hemispheres. Right? That the left hemisphere, not totally, but it has a bias towards the individuality consciousness. Right? And the right hemisphere has a bias towards the unity consciousness sort of issues. Right? So if it's all together as one brain, right, you don't have that separation between the individuality and the unity, so you don't so naturally get the associativity. See that philosophically, like they're saying there. Right, that's why they're somewhat more philosophical. Now, why imaginative, adventurous? When you actually give the unity consciousness a more separate place to kind of seed itself, you know, that awakens more of those energies that are related to the, you know, founded in those unity biased adjutants, like the sixth adjutant, right? So that there can be, it's easier to be imaginative when you have kind of a place to just be imaginative and you don't have to deal with all the practical issues at the same time. You can kind of, those can be set aside in the left hemisphere and it frees the right hemisphere to not have to deal with those at the same time. See, so one-brainers don't have that luxury. I mean, they never can kind of abstract like that. They're forced to consider everything all together. Well, so you can see how that might be a positive thing in some ways,
yeah.
Right? It's harder for them to go off on la-la land tangents,
yeah,
than us. They stay more grounded because they can't so easily disconnect from the individuality and their groundedness.
Very primitive, aren't they?
What was that?
They're also going to be very primitive.
Not necessarily primitive. I mean, there's worlds in light and life that are one-brainers, okay? Right? They're not primitive in that sense,
yeah.
Right? It's just that they start out much more grounded than two-brainers do, right? You know, like remember we were talking about, three-brainers start off kind of above the ground a bit, right? And then the two-brainers are, you know, Mr. In-Between. As the old song goes, you know.
Now, Adam's natives, do they come as one, two, and three-brain beings?
Doesn't this bring in an interesting question? Yeah, see, remember how they don't talk about that? How does that work? Now, you know that those children,
yeah,
see, have got to match up. Yeah. Right? I mean, Adamson must have been in the two-brainer. But you're going, well, doesn't seem like there's probably one and two and three brainers on Gerasim. Oh, is that? So is that one of the things that happens when Adam and Eve, when they're downstepped, you know, and made it so they procreate in a certain way, is that one of the issues? Does the life carriers have to make it so that they procreate one brain or two brain or three brain children? Yeah. Seems to be that you're kind of forced to that recognition, see? But exactly what's the brain of material sons and daughters, they don't tell us. I don't know. You could only speculate. If you had to guess, well, maybe they're three-brained, right? And it seems like it'd be easier to think about, if you start with three, you could obviously downstep that to two, just make the third smaller like the two-brainers. Or you could downstep it even further and have the two come together as one. So maybe that would be the first speculation you'd make, that material sons and daughters are three-brainers.
Didn't they mention that they were a bit telepathic for distances?
Well, there's these other senses and things, and they have additional, mechanical things, in their bodies and whatnot, yeah.
Isn't a definite answer.
But they don't tell us, but they just, but you can see how, if you speculate on it, that would be my first guess. I mean, because you can see that they're telling you that 3, 2, 1 are stacked vertically, that there's a higher spiritual nature to a three brain than a one brain. They're stacked vertically, and at material sons and daughters are at the top of any vertical stack, right? And then we're talking about downstepping, so I think that's probably what you have to assume.
Now, will we be growing into a higher brain type?
We leave all that behind once you die.
Mirage.
Right. I mean, a soul, which is your mirage brain, right, isn't one brain, two brain, three brain. Right? I mean, it's just a single, sphere of some sort. Right.
Part of our evolution is not going to be relevant.
Right. You leave behind all these things on the nativity sphere. In terms of directly, obviously, someone who started out as a three-brainer starts out differently with on the first mansion world than someone that started out as a one-brainer, right? But by the time you get to Gerasim, you've transcended any sort of a limit, inherent limitation that gave to you. You move up above that sort of limitation. Let's see. So if you had explained that, and then just the three-brainers, but somewhat less spiritual, ethical, and worshipful than the three-brained orders. Okay, and why? Because even though it's kind of, for us, left hemisphere, more individuality consciousness, right hemisphere, a little more unity consciousness, it's not pure. Right? There's a little of both seated on both hemispheres, right? And that's because we're two-brainers. If you go up to a three-brainer, all of the physical stuff, the very immediately physical stuff can be in that third brain, that lower brain, and it frees up the two hemispheres to be much more pure.
Oh, wow.
As individuality consciousness on the left and unity consciousness on the right, if that pattern holds. But one being individuality consciousness, one being unity consciousness, much more purely. And so that's why they can be more spiritual, ethical, worshipful, because they can have that unity consciousness in a much purer fashion without having to cohabitate a bit immediately with individuality consciousness, or spiritual consciousness cohabiting with material consciousness, if you want to say it that way.
So we gotta get going.
Right? Yep.
From the two hemisphere type of the Urantia cerebral cortex, you can, by analogy, graph some of the one brain, something of the one brain type. The third brain of the three brained orders is best conceived as an involvement of your lower or rudimentary form of brain, which is developed to the point where it functions chiefly in control of physical activities, leaving the two superior brains free for higher engagement, one for intellectual functions and the other for spiritual counterparting activities of the thought adjuster.
See, I already...
what you just said.
Right, see, that's what I was saying. I was going to say up front. That's why I was taking as long as I did. But there you can see how they were describing that. And see, they're calling it intellectual functions in the one, right? I mean, where where you're kind of connecting the dots of individuality, as opposed to letting go of the dots and just thinking in unity, mode. Okay,
that's interesting. The spiritual counterparting activities.
Right. So that's why initially you're relating to that father fragment as a quote unquote spirit fragment. You're initially just relating to its unity aspect. That's why it's appropriate to call it a spirit fragment. It isn't technically a fragment of spirit substance. It's a fragment of deity, right? But that's what they're just pointing that out. Initially, you know, it's your unity consciousness relating to its unity, and it's catalyzing, you know, your unity consciousness. Your individuality consciousness doesn't need to be catalyzed. You're a blob of protoplasm. Okay, it's already, you know, there in spades, right? Right. And the adjuster is trying to get this unity consciousness up at an equal magnitude so the two can play together in a balanced way. Okay? Okay?
While the terrestrial attainments of the one-brain races are slightly limited in comparison with the two-brain orders, the older planets of the three-brain group exhibit civilizations that would astound your ancients, and which would somewhat shame yours by comparison. In mechanical development and material civilization, even in intellectual progress, the two-brain mortal worlds are able to equal the three-brain spheres. But in the higher control of mind and development of intellectual and spiritual reciprocation, you're somewhat inferior.
You see, again, you should be able to appreciate that. That's after I described it all. Those three-brainers, it's much more immediate for them to develop a personal living philosophy. They have this very wonderful separation between the two that can have this profound super-additive consequence. And there's no muddling, you know, that blurs it up. So
much muddled.
That's why their civilization would astound you. I mean, it would be so profoundly wise, you know, holistic, philosophic. Right? A two-brainer has enough of the individuality separated. They can get all the technology stuff going and whatnot pretty well. It's going to be tougher for the one-brainers. Because they've got it all muddled together, and they can't escape that fact. So they've got to work through that. You know, their unity consciousness is going to constantly get in the way of them making progress on science.
So it's going to take more time, I would think.
Right, it's going to take more time. Right, but all of them are going to get to light and life. But you can suspect that one-brainers are going to take a longer time to get to light and life than two-brainers or three-brainers. Okay.
All such comparative estimates concerning the intellectual progress or the spiritual attainments of any world or group of worlds should, in fairness, recognize planetary age. Much, very much, depends on age, the help of the biologic uplifters, and the subsequent missions of the various orders of divine sons.
Obviously. You get a better biologic foundation that makes up for a lot of this. Get a philosophical uplifter, you know, the magisterial son, the world is going to be more philosophic. Right? It's just that the three-brainers are more just naturally philosophic than the one-brainers. But once they all have a philosophic uplifter, they're going to be relatively equally philosophic. Okay.
While the three-brain peoples are capable of a slightly higher planetary evolution than either the one- or two-brain daughters, all have the same type of life plasm and carry on planetary activities in very similar ways, much as do human beings on Urantia. These three types of mortals are distributed throughout the worlds of the local systems. In the majority of cases, planetary conditions have very little to do with the decisions of the light carriers to project these varied orders of mortals on the different worlds. It is the prerogative of the life carriers thus to plan and execute.
Okay, so the first part of that paragraph, again reminding you that the mind has an absolutely separate source, right? So kind of the basic things carry on, you know, independent of one, two, three brained, right? You can have the same kind of mindal, you know, you get the same seven adjutants, they're same potential. So you can develop a civilization predicated on the diversity of all seven of those adjutants, okay? Quite independent of the one, two, three brain thing. So again, reminding of how this is about mind here, not just matter. And then pointing out that that you don't, it's not like super breathers all have to be, three-brained, or, you know, or sub-breathers all have to be one-brained, or something like that. And, you know, they're just making that point there at the end, that all of these physical differences we've been talking about really don't have anything to do with the one, two, three-brain thing. That's a totally separate thing that's just at the discretion of the life carriers. Like, I don't know. Why don't we try a three-brained on this sub-breather world this time? See how that works. Or,
let's go for four.
they're just mixing it up. And exactly what they use to base their, you know, I'm sure they don't flip a coin, right? A three-sided coin. You know, what do they do? So they're just telling you it is a prerogative. Not the only one either. See, you know, it doesn't say the prerogative. It's a prerogative of the life carriers. The life carriers have a lot of say about what they do. And we talked about that back in the life carrier paper. Right? Okay, wrap it up here.
These three orders stand on an equal footing in the ascension career. Each must traverse the same intellectual scale of development, and each must master the same spiritual tests of progression. The system administration and the constellation over control of these different worlds are uniformly free from discrimination. Even the regimes of the planetary princes are identical.
So that's an important thing. Like when you said the one-brainer is more primitive, okay? Even the planetary princes' administrations are identical. I mean, they don't go, okay, we've got to dumb it down for the one-brainers, you know, my staff. No. Right? They put the same challenge before them, whether they're one, two, or three-brainer. Because the whole point is self-mastery. You notice how they mentioned that, you know, a bit about mastery there. The whole point is to rise up above what you are naturally. Whatever the heck you are naturally, three-brain, one-brain, sub-breather, whatever the heck you are naturally, and the way that makes you tend to think, the whole point is to transcend that, no matter what it is. There's nothing divine about any of those beginnings. You know, the whole point is to transcend being merely a three-brainer. You know, none of these things, you know, really in a significant way take you up. We might talk about them as being vertical, but it's vertical down in the thin little slab at the bottom, okay? It's not very highly vertical, okay? Get up above all those physical differences into the common mind. Rise above what you are genetically. That's the whole point, to rise above it. Don't glorify it. Don't think that your boundary conditions are God's existential will for you. You know, He doesn't will you to be your temperament right now. What He desires is for you to transcend that. You know, don't just be maternal or paternal or parental or whatever. I mean, or one-brained or three-brained. The whole point is to transcend that. Your challenge is just to figure out where you start. It's like, oh, I'm starting as a female. Okay, those are my initial challenges. I need to transcend being merely a female. Point is not to drag your female temperament to the Isle of Paradise. Right? Anymore, I'm supposed to drag my male temperament to the Isle of Paradise. Right? They're not going to let it in the door. Right? None of those temperaments get into the Havona, right?
No, but my therapist says I do have to get more in touch with my female side.
Your therapist probably also is basically a materialist and thinks you're a blob of protoplasm too, right? I mean, yeah, that's another thing we need to recognize, that our psychologists and psychiatrists and whatnot have a very materialistic worldview in general.
Actually, I think it's kind of interesting.
No, I mean, you know, I mean, what's one of the indispensable things that you can't leave Gerasim until you get a definitive relationship to the other sex?
Until you have a baby.
I mean, why not start right here like that? You know, so there's a truth to what that therapist is saying, right? I mean, right. You know, she's just reminding you kind of what I just said. You know, the whole point is not to glorify your initial condition. Right? It's not an end, it's a beginning. All right. So we'll continue on with these next time here. The next one is a very intriguing thing that tends to boggle the mind when you're first exposed to it. So we'll get to that next time here. Let's take a moment, everyone.